Support comes from Empower Missouri's Food Security Coalition, working to ensure access to adequate nutrition for all Missourians, from public school meals to food programs for seniors. More at empowermissouri.org/foodsecurity.
Now that Missouri legislators have returned from spring break, they're getting into the issues that could provoke the most debate and controversy. And one of the people at the center of all of this is Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz. The Republican from Sullivan joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about the big issues for the rest of the legislative session and why there will almost certainly be extra time this year to deal with congressional redistricting. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me today as my co-host, St. Louis Public Radio State House reporter
Jacqueline Driscoll.
And our very special guest today, he is the pro tem of the Missouri Senate, a Republican from Franklin County. Our guest today is
Senator Dave Schatz.
Senator, thank you for coming back on the podcast. We have a literal ton of issues to talk about, to use the cliche. But I want to start off with an open-ended question. What are some of the things that you're expecting the Senate to deal with as the legislature hits the second half of the 2021 session?
Well, first and foremost, Jason, obviously the House has just sent the budget to the Missouri Senate. The one constitutional obligation that we have in the legislature is passing a balanced budget. So that is going to be, obviously, in the next few weeks, is going to take up quite a bit of the focus. There are several other things that obviously have been in the mill and are continuing to work through the process, but that will begin to form and shape and take quite a bit of our focus going forward from this point. I would also say that obviously I have a very big interest in transportation. And again, the fuel tax is something that is on the other side of the building. I'm going to be working with House leadership and members over there to try to see if we can get that thing across the finish line, and to the governor's desk is a big priority of mine. And I'm hopeful that this year we finally address something that we haven't addressed for 25 years. And the election integrity is something I think that we will continue to deal with this year. I think that's probably in the next few weeks. Initiative petition reform, making sure that out-of-state interests, special interest groups that have in the past seemed like they've had tremendous amount of power when it comes to changing our state constitution with clever ballot language. They sneak what we would consider to be some constitutional changes on the ballot. Sometimes in voter turnout is very low. Obviously, we have sent the Wayfair legislation to the House as well. I think that's something that we're very hopeful that we can finally get that off the table. And one of the things that they've been back and forth between both chambers is the conversation about education reform. The main idea there is to make sure that every Missouri child has access to a quality education. And some of the system, clearly the system isn't working for all students. And so we need to make sure that every Missouri student or every Missouri citizen has an opportunity to get that quality education. And so I think that some of the things that we've already passed and to continue to talk about police reforms, the police bill of rights, COVID liability, and then continue to roll back restrictive regulation so that Missourians can continue to reopen their businesses and get back to school and get the economy back going is probably going to be some of the priorities. And hopefully that we'll get those things accomplished before the end of session.
I would love to hop right into the budget because obviously as we're taping this on Friday, April 2nd, the House just passed its version of the budget bills yesterday on Thursday. Obviously, there were some good things in the budget bills that were sent over, but they were things like a raise for state workers, fully funding education, but that was overshadowed by the decision of Republicans in the chamber not to fund Medicaid expansion. We're hearing from House Democrats that they are hopeful that the Senate will be able to work that back into the budget bills. What's the fate of funding for Medicaid expansion that you can tell so far?
Well, again, I think, obviously now receiving it back over, I mean, obviously that would have been something it typically would have been in House Bill 11, and obviously it was not in there. I think there was, and again, I don't know if it was House Bill 20 or where they tried to attempt to fund Medicaid expansion for, obviously it failed. But I think that the conversation there, I really probably wouldn't be able to tell you. I think there are folks that probably, on the other side of the aisle, obviously they want to make sure that Medicaid expansion is funded. But I myself personally, was not a advocate or supporter for the Medicaid expansion, for the reasons I believe that we have concerns. There was no funding mechanism, when this initiative petition was passed. And I believe if there had been a funding mechanism associated with it, it may not have passed because voters and people weren't told where it was going to be paid for and how it was going to be accomplished. And so whether or not, the amount of dollars, obviously there is a, claim that the feds, portion, they're paying a large portion of the Medicaid program. But into the future, we know that is a possibility that's going to be on the burdens of Missouri taxpayers. And so we have these concerns as to how much that's going to impact our state budget. And at the end of the day, I believe it will be something that will cost, us from the education line in order to fund that program. And so obviously that's where the conversation is going to be and whether or not we actually fund that. And I think that at some point it may be a decision the courts weigh into. If the Senate chooses not to fund it, then the courts will probably weigh in at some point in time as to whether or not it's a requirement of the state. I believe we have constitutional grounds to say, without a funding mechanism, the legislature are the appropriators, and we make the decisions, and therefore we choose to fund programs that we appropriate money for.
So another person from your party, the leader of your party, Governor Mike Parson, who was also a pretty staunch opponent of Medicaid expansion as it was being discussed, as we recognized that it was going to hit the ballot. But yesterday, again on Thursday, he did come out and say, as he has, that this was the will of the voters and it's something that he appropriated for in his budget proposals. And it's something that the legislature needs to do. Jason, do you have a clip to play?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, we're going to see where that process goes. I mean, the House, we put it in our budget and in the governor's budget. We planned on funding that. So the House took the action they did. We'll see what the Senate does and we'll see what the end of that shows. But I think we're a long way from getting that to the finish line.
So obviously the power of the purse lies within the hands of the legislature for a reason. And the executive branch can make their recommendations. But again, it falls on the House and the Senate to appropriate state dollars where they feel that it needs to go. But hearing from the governor on this, I mean, will that have any impact as it moves through the Senate? Because again, it does sound like he is expecting the Senate to do something with Medicaid expansion based on that interview that he had yesterday.
Well, I'm not sure that I read into the governor's comments that, I think that what he alluded to, and if I heard it again, I could probably be more specific, but he said, obviously, we'll have to wait and see where the Senate goes with this. Obviously, the legislature does, have the power of the purse and over the appropriation process. I know it's in part of the governor's recommendation. The governor feels like, obviously, that voters voted for this thing, and I think that they did, but I believe Medicaid expansion probably passed in about 7 counties of the state. If I'm correct on that. But I also realize this, the one thing that I believe we have constitutional grounds to stand on is that there was no funding mechanism in there. I can't read you verbatim from the Constitution, but obviously voters cannot, we cannot without a, there are certain things that you can vote that has funding mechanisms associated with them. But I think this is bad policy of going down a path when people put something on the ballot and just say, it's up to the legislature to figure it out at that point in time. And that's why I believe that you're getting pushback from the House and probably from the Senate on this particular issue, is there was no funding mechanism. And I think when you're up front with people and you tell voters what the reality is say, okay, if they would have said, we're going to create a new tax or a new process, or we're going to take it from education bucket or where it's going to come from, but here's how we're going to pay for it. It's a good program, but they got to find a funding mechanism. So I believe, again, that conversation will continue on in the Missouri Senate. I can't predict whether or not what we come out of there with, but I'd say it would be likely that we're probably going to push back on this issue. And that's why I think when we talk about IP reform, I think it's very critical for that we have a conversation about that as we go further into, down the road.
Now, before we move on to another topic, because I really do want to move on to something else, if Missouri expands Medicaid under the American Rescue Plan, the state would get well over $1 billion. And I don't know what that money, like the specifics of where that money could be used for, but it stands to reason that you could in some ways bank that money and then pay the state match of Medicaid expansion for 10 to 15 years while you figure out a permanent funding mechanism. So how does that contradict your claims that there's no funding mechanism to actually implement Medicaid expansion?
Well, again, I think that the federal matching money that you may be talking about obviously has, there are certain requirements that those funds can be used for. But we, you know, the reality is, Jason, that our Medicaid program as it is right now is growing faster than our state's budget. And so just making, you know, that is, and whether or not we can, can have some reforms and gain control of that growth. But expanding the population only creates the problem and makes it larger going into the future. And so since I've been in the legislature, this is my 11th year, we have seen our Medicaid program continue to eat up the growth of our state's budget year after year after year. And so I think that is a grave concern. And so some of this money, obviously it is going to have strings attached to it. It's going to have certain requirements. And I think we will investigate, all of our options when it comes to those federal dollars and what we can utilize them for.
I do want to continue on the topic of the American Rescue Plan, because regardless of what the legislature does on Medicaid, the state is going to be getting, at last estimates, $2.8 billion from the federal government. And I'm interested to hear if there's been any conversation among Republicans about what they're going to do with that money. Again, I don't know what quote unquote strings are attached to it. I imagine you can't just do whatever you want with it, but I've gotten the sense that there is some open-endedness to what you can do with that money. And I'm interested to hear what Republicans that control the legislature have in mind there.
Well, I think, again, the one thing we won't receive from the federal government probably until sometime, in May, is the guidance on the stimulus funds and how they can be spent. I mean, that is the same day as our budget deadline is this year. And it'll have very little impact on this year's session and or budget. I think it'll be something that'll, those funds will not arrive all at one time. So it's possible we could begin discussing during a special session when we come back. Obviously we're going to be doing that for redistricting, but there's a better chance than not that most funding discussions will take place next session. So again, a lot of it is where these buckets of money can be used. Obviously I have, there is another, stimulus that is being proposed by the federal government, on infrastructure. A lot of things are open-ended and unknown right now as to where those funds can be utilized and needed. Again, I'm a big advocate for infrastructure. And so I would like to see us put some money towards some of the needs that, the ongoing needs that we have been building up over time because of our lack of being able to meet the needs of our transportation system. So, but Jason, I guess until we actually see, where we can spend that money and how we're going to do it and when it's going to be available is going to really determine the conversation where it goes.
I know that there is some talk at the federal level about President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan to repair some roads and bridges, but Missouri took its own action, or the Senate did rather, to repair some roads and bridges by utilizing funds and a gas tax. Senator Schatz, I know that this is something in my time, I know that this is something that you have been an advocate for, and it finally made it through the Senate. First off, have you heard about perspectives moving in the House at all? And also, again, I would just like to give you the opportunity for our listeners to talk a little bit about this gas tax. I know that Missourians don't have much of an appetite for taxes in general, but why you feel that this is an important one to get done for the state?
Well, let me first off say, you know, the problem that we face has been the same problem that's been since my time entering the legislature some 11 years ago, that we have had a funding shortfall to maintain our infrastructure system here in the state of Missouri. The most important things that we do and government can do is to provide the infrastructure necessary to make sure that we can attract business, industry, our citizens. Citizens don't build roads. And so that is one function that's a responsibility, I believe, of the government to do, is to provide the infrastructure necessary. We have the seventh largest system in the United States, and we fund it 49th. It's, as a business person, it's pretty easy for me to see we've got a problem there. And we are currently unfunding our needs to the tune of about $800 million annually. We've probably amassed somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 billion of unfunded needs in our transportation system. And obviously, you can't continue down the path we are. And that's why when I've proposed before other mechanisms to try to fund transportation through a proposal a few years ago that was a sales tax proposal that the voters rejected. Prop D was an opportunity for voters to be able to do that. And the one thing I learned from Prop D, obviously ballot language is very critical in explaining to voters exactly. And a lot of what we heard on Prop D is they were confused. They weren't sure. It had Olympic medals associated with it, highway patrol. But what we did see is there was about 1.1 million people supported the idea of transportation funding, a little over $1.2 million rejected it. Therefore, the question is, what do we need to do now? And so the proposal that we came up with is the South Carolina model that allows, what they have done is that allows for an increase in the motor fuel tax done through the legislature that is refundable to the citizens that choose to apply for a rebate. And therefore, you can meet the needs of both worlds. Those who believe in investing in transportation can. Those who do want to get a refund can also do that. And so I think we've kind of come up with an idea that obviously we didn't coin the idea. South Carolina did, and it's been very successful for them. But it will address the need that we have not addressed in 25 years. And the amount of revenue that we need, obviously, some of the federal money that could come in could probably help us catch up to some of those, that list of ongoing list of things that need to be addressed. But just for maintaining in the future, we've got to increase through inflation. We have lost our buying power. And so the motor fuel tax is the mechanism right now that we've been funding transportation for over 100 years. And I think it's the right thing to do. It's a responsible thing to do. The users pay for it, but obviously allows people that feel that that we shouldn't be able to do it, have an opportunity to get a rebate. And so I'm pretty excited that we can get this done. I know it's not a popular issue with some of our more conservative members, but it's the best of both worlds as far as I'm concerned.
How much would the gas tax go up if this ends up passing?
We have proposed 2.5 cents a year for 5 years. So it would be a total of 12.5 cents. And so that would produce about $500 million once it's fully implemented in new revenue. But again, we know that if there is a rebate portion to that, it would probably, you know, what South Carolina has seen is they've got about a 15% redemption. We believe ours would probably be a little bit higher than that. You know, it could be as high as 20-25% redemption rate, depending on, you know, how people decide to do that. And so, again, we may net about 10 cents, but that would go a long way. It doesn't get us to the $800 million shortfall that we're currently at, but it's a lot further down the road than we are right now. And again, we've ignored this problem for many, many years. And so, and I do know that the infrastructure proposal that we've seen from the Biden administration is a little disappointing to me, because out of the $2 trillion that they're talking about spending, less than 6% of that is has been dedicated for roads and bridges, about $115 billion. And so 43% of that is spent on, or 43% of the that is spent on mass transit. And so there's $165 billion more than roads and bridges, and so on mass transit. So I was driving in to my office here and coming down the interstate today. The condition of our roads and bridges obviously is very critical for us to be able to continue to attract business and industry in this state, because we have, you know, the geographic advantage that most states don't. We live in the center of the United States, and we are the hub and should be the hub of commerce, you know, for the United States.
Have you had any indication what the House will do? I haven't spoken to Speaker Rob Vescovo about this, but I do remember one of my questions for Speaker Elijah Haar was about the gas tax, and he basically shut it down before, you know, I even had the chance to ask many questions. It just wasn't something that he said that the caucus had an appetite for. Do you have any indication as to what the Republicans in the House may do with this?
Well, if there's any indication, if the Senate is any indication of where we believe the House will potentially end up, you know, I believe that there's an appetite there. It'll be a bipartisan effort in order to do it. You know, the House passed the measure out of the Senate chamber 21-13. I think that we'll probably see, you know, in some shape, form, or fashion that you know, that will be somewhere similar what we can get accomplished there. I will be working very diligently along with the coalition of people that support this in order to make sure that we can get this thing across the finish line. But it is something, obviously, you know, Speaker Vescovo is not a strong champion for. I think he's missing a great opportunity, you know, in order to address one of the most problem issues that we've been facing the state for a long time. But I do think that we will negotiate and work out to where that thing gets an opportunity to get to the floor, to get an honest discussion on it and get a vote on that thing. And I believe we'll prevail. And I'm very optimistic about that. And when it gets to the governor's office, I'm certain he will sign it into law.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz. He is a Republican from Sullivan. I want to touch on the election-related issues that you alluded to before. Some of the things that I've heard beyond, you know, raising the threshold to pass constitutional amendments from, like, a simple majority to a supermajority, are trying to get more signatures. There's been a number of election administrative ideas that have passed through the House, and that includes things like eliminating the presidential primary, kind of making the photo ID requirement in Missouri effective again after a court decision made it less effective. And the thing that I'm actually most interested in, creating a no-excuse absentee ballot period for in-person voting. So I want to talk about the last one of those things first. The thing that I have discovered after reporting on the whole absentee ballot issue over the last year is that Missouri election officials have unequivocally said that Missouri's excuse-based system is basically worthless. There's no way for them to figure out if the excuse that they're putting down is actually true. So if you put down that you're going to be out of town, there's no way to actually prove that. And they would just like to go to a no-excuse model because they see the current system as a farce. So what's kind of the Senate's view on at least making a in-person period where you can just vote for any reason rather than having to say you're going to be out of town or you're going to be working election day at the polls or something like that?
Well, I agree. I think that the process that we have in place and again, a no-excuse absentee ballot process that is obviously has the protections and measures that we think are necessary to provide for the integrity we want, I think it's fine. Giving people an opportunity to have some flexibility there is I think it's perfectly well, as long as it contains the right measures and constraints to make sure that all the boxes are checked, that we know that the individuals that are voting are who they say they are. And so whether or not, you know, they're going to be there on election day. Now, I'm a big advocate. I do believe that we have election day for a purpose. I don't think that we should have an open-ended absentee ballot process, because as things change, you know, a lot of these campaigns that they run that, you know, obviously you get down to the critical nature, and we want people to have as much information to make an informed decision on who they choose and what, or if they're voting on a ballot measure and all the things that end up in a campaign process. And some places obviously have, you know, voters have voted, you know, and then new information has been produced. And so I just don't want to make sure that runway is too far, but I do think allowing voters an opportunity to have a chance to vote with absentee is fine, as long as it's not too long and it has the integrity measures that we believe are necessary.
So when you say integrity measures, I think what you're referring to is that if you go to, let's just say, an election authority's in-person absentee ballot location, so that may be like a Board of Elections location, our clerk.
It'd be your county, yeah, county clerk. Yes.
Yeah, something like that. You would have to show a government-issued photo ID in order to do that. Now, there are going to be some people who don't like that. There are also going to be people who are going to be like, showing a photo ID is a lot more convenient than getting your ballot notarized, which is what a lot of people had to do last year if they didn't fall into the COVID excuse or anything like that. Why do you think that would be a necessary thing to include in any no-excuse in-person absentee period?
Well, Jason, I think first and foremost, again, I think, you know, people want to have faith and confidence in the election process. And I think that is a measure that's critical for us to be able to provide that, is to make sure that whoever that is that's coming before that election official or that county clerk is voting, and they live where they say they live, and they are who they say they are. And again, you cannot go and get on an airplane. You cannot do certain things. You can't rent a car. I mean, you have to have a basic form of ID in order for you to be able to accomplish most anything in our society today. And just making sure that that individual is the person who says they are is critical in us to believing that the election process is fair. And so if you leave that open-ended without that protection there, I'm not sure people have the faith and confidence in elections of people just going and voting whenever they want. And that's why I think it's critical. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we will find a way to make sure that we have that type of integrity in our election process so that we don't have people questioning the outcomes.
I don't want to get off Jason's favorite topic of voting and redistricting and all that fun stuff, but I do want to switch gears a little bit, because I do have a question regarding illegal gaming machines. I asked this question because initially going into session, and I think last session, which obviously got derailed by the coronavirus, but the topic of expanding sports gaming was something that seemed to be a priority, or at least an issue that several people were wanting to discuss. However, you've recently said that if we have the topic of expanding sports gambling in the state of Missouri, we need to first discuss illegal gaming machines. What's the status of that? Is there an appetite to do it? And we're winding down. I know that it's only the beginning of April, but, you know, as we're coming into these final weeks of session, there's still several big issues to get done. Is this likely to be a discussion this session, or do you see it moving possibly for 2022?
Well, the illegal gaming issue that I believe has been plaguing the state for some for the last few years now has continued to grow in number. Again, I think that you know, my desire to see you know, the legislation that I proposed to try to put that issue you know, in check. I'm hopeful to get that across the finish line. Obviously, we believe that we have the legal opinions, and we have case law that these games that are out there right now that are not regulated by any government entity have been deemed illegal. There was a case in Platte County that was adjudicated and a guilty verdict rendered. There was also another case, I believe, in Linn County where another person pled guilty for, you know, these types of gambling machines that are out there. And so I am passionate about trying to get that across the finish line. But I realize that is connected to desire to expand and offer some sort of a legalized option when it comes to whether it's VLTs, VGTs, and then you have the issue of sports wagering. All of those kind of issues converge together, and we've been working through that. I guarantee you there will be a conversation yet this year on that topic. I know that it's a priority. The priority for me to end illegal gaming is a priority for me, but there is a priority for other legislators that would like to see some form of expansion. But I have said many times that I'm not willing to expand legalized gambling until we get rid of the illegal gaming. Makes no sense. If we can't take care of illegal gaming, we have no business expanding legal gaming at this point in time. So, but that conversation's coming. I look forward to seeing where it ends up. But I'm not sure that we actually know where the sentiment of the legislature is until we get to that issue.
So we only have a few minutes left, and as much as I'd like to talk for 3,000 minutes about redistricting, I'm not going to do that because it's not likely that the legislature is going to actually take up congressional redistricting until winter. And that's my question for you. When do you expect the special session to approve a congressional map to happen?
You know, Jason, we've kind of worked from the timeline of when we believe that we'll have the information necessary for us to begin the process. And so, I mean, it's likely that we are looking at December timeframe, somewhere in that December timeframe for us to, you know, again, that's out there if all things being considered occur. And there's a lot of things that have to happen in between there. But I mean, it's likely that would be the time frame in which we would be find ourselves in some form of special session working on the congressional redistricting maps. If something delays that process, I mean, we could see where we may have to address whether or not we move the filing date at that point in time. But I believe we can get it done. I believe the way that we've looked at that, we'll have an opportunity to get it accomplished. But we can't, if we don't get the data and the information necessary to make those things happen, that's really kind of out of our control.
And we'll be talking more about congressional redistricting later in the year. But the issue really about the filing date is state legislative redistricting, because I did an article a couple months ago about the timeline for state legislative redistricting. And if the commissions for the House and Senate districts deadlock, you could have a situation where the maps are not finalized until end of first quarter 2022, which would hit directly into the filing period in February and March. Do you expect that the legislature is going to have to move the filing deadline back to April because of state legislative redistricting being likely not finished until next year?
I think that's a strong possibility, Jason. Again, it depends on when this information comes, how they're able to work in it, and if they can come up with a consensus agreement, and I'm not sure, I probably can't go back in history and tell you how many times that was agreed to, and 7 out of 10 agreed to the maps that were drawn, and whether or not the courts end up drawing these maps, all of that's going to play into this process. But it's likely that it could be very interesting, you know, as people are trying to determine what their legislative districts looks like, what their potential Senate districts may look like going in the future. Again, I came in 2000, I was elected in 2010, came right into the redistricting process and got a very quick understanding of what those legislative districts can end up like, because I ended up in a House district that was drawn into four pieces. And so it is critical, you know, for folks as they kind of begin to try to make those types of decisions.
My last question for you, I have read elsewhere you are mulling over whether to run in the wild and wacky U.S. Senate contest. You will be termed out of the Senate after 2022. You would be an interesting candidate. I think you would have to increase your name recognition, because just because you're the pro tem doesn't mean you're widely known. But when you ran for the Senate in 2014, you were able to put a lot of your own money into that race, and I think that you would be able to self-fund and become a pretty viable candidate pretty quickly. What's kind of your thought process on getting into the U.S. Senate race in 2022, and what's going to be kind of some of the key factors behind your decision-making process?
Well, first and foremost, obviously, a decision like this, and I've said, many people have always said, you know, ask the question, you know, what are you going to do next? I did not begin my political career with a plan in journey in mind, that I have a stair-stepping ladder that I'm trying to work my way to Washington, D.C. Again, as you stated, I didn't anticipate, I wasn't running for the Missouri Senate until my legislative district was drawn into four pieces. And I ended up with, no options before me other than the Missouri Senate, and ended up in the Missouri Senate. Here we are today. And so I didn't have the anticipation of running for Congress and or United States Senate before me, hadn't had plans to do that. But politics is about timing and opportunity. I think Governor Parsons, when he was elected lieutenant governor, didn't envision the fact that he'd be sitting in the governor's mansion today, but the opportunity was afforded to him, and here he is today. I will say that, I'm probably not the most likely household name that you would, whenever you talk about United States Senate, of someone. But again, Washington, D.C. and our federal government is a disaster. And I do believe that the people of Missouri deserve better, and they desperately need someone that has a bit more common sense, and I believe I offer that. I believe, Jason, that if we make the decision, it will be a prayerful one. My family and I understand the dynamics of making a decision this magnitude. It's not something that we take lightly, but it is something that we are seriously considering. And I think that we would provide a viable option for voters that would bring something to Washington D.C. that they desperately need.
Well, obviously, we'll be looking forward to your final decision on that, because that contest is shaping up to be, to excuse the cliche, a barn burner of epic proportion. But Senator, thank you so much for your time this morning. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How can people follow you on Twitter, Jacqueline?
Driscoll NPR.
And how can people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web, Senator?
Unfortunately, Jason, I probably can't tell you that, because I am not well versed in the Twitter universe, and so that would be hard for me to explain. So
@DaveShots26 @DaveShots26. I know this. Because I'm looking at it at my phone right now. I'm typing frantic. Yes, @DaveShots26, and you can also go to the Missouri Senate's website to learn more about
that. That is dave.shots@missourisenate.gov. Yeah, that is great. So
thank you so much, and until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.